Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, damas y caballeros, leave it in.
And welcome back to another edition of Leaving the Ring Radio. I'm your host, Dave Duenas, with my co-host, Mr. Gabriel Montoya. And what a past weekend of fights that we had. And what a great weekend we're about to have coming this Friday and Saturday. So, you know, a lot of stacked cards, a lot of boxing talk, a lot of things that are just starting to begin in boxing that a lot of us are going to start, you know, putting in our two cents, I guess you can say. From boxing matches being made, like, you know, Alvarez versus Angulo, to the reality shows that are being made and they're going to be launching, especially one I believe tonight is going to be The Fighters by no other than Dana White, the guy that used to ran around, who used to say, I don't know if you remember this quote, but this is a quote that Dana used to walk around and basically by building his formula to build their martial arts empire, especially around television when he started Ultimate Fighting Championship. The quote that he always would say is, we basically use boxing as a model of what not to do when we build UFC. So whatever boxing does, we do the opposite. Kind of weird, huh? I don't know. There's just two things. One is, obviously, last week we talked about Dana White and Nevada testing and how he's trying to avoid it, saying that it's stupid, weird, and et cetera. But now you got to start questioning, why is he doing a reality series about boxing? That I have to ask. Is the formula not working anymore? Remember this, people. I used to always say that the UFC was a baby sport. It was a new sport that was coming in the scene of the combat world, coming on the scene of the combat television. So a lot of newly fans that couldn't grasp or relate to boxing because it's a world sport and sometimes countries drive the sport, there was left a lot of people that couldn't identify, especially white Americans here in the States. They couldn't identify with boxing because of the international atmosphere that it brought. So it needed something to kind of grasp on, and it did. But have you seen, have you started, how things start to notice now is that, for one, I used to say that fighters are going to get smarter. They're going to start realizing that they bring a draw, so they should get a bigger cut than the monopoly that Dana White has, you know, basically has modeled for the UFC. Two, the writers are going to start backing up the fighters, and you're starting to see that a whole lot now. You know, MMA writers are starting to say, hey, this is not fair. These guys are not making the amount that they should just because they're in a combat sport. They're risking their lives. And then thirdly, we're going to see how true their fans were going to really be. As soon as fighters start not to give a full performance because they knew there was a risk in losing a potential fight up ahead, or at the same time, they're like, you know what, this is not the fight that I wanted. So there's a lack of motivation. We are going to see the drop of exciting fights when it came down to that sport, and we're starting to see that. So do you think that Dana now is like, okay, well, doing the opposite? Well, boxing is still at an ultra high. I mean, we're not the We don't gather the numbers like the NFL does. We're not bringing those 19 million numbers to the household, but we're certainly, when it comes to pay-per-views, we're bringing some pretty high numbers, as well as HBO. You know, even a regular televised HBO program or Showtime championship, they're bringing some very good numbers, you know, from one point up, million. Mm-hmm. So obviously boxing is still doing something minorly correct when it comes to marketing and getting their fights out to the public. So maybe Dana White is changing his tune. I don't know. What's your thoughts, Gabriel, about this whole reality series that he's releasing on Discovery Channel?
I think Dana's keeping the same disingenuous tune that he always has. You know, he's a promoter. and promoters will say one thing today, different thing tomorrow. Dana always kind of speaks out of both sides of his mouth, you know. We're killing boxing. And then when it's convenient so that he can, like, piggyback off a Floyd Mayweather fight or a Pacquiao fight, I really love watching these guys. I'm a huge fan of boxing. I've been a fan the whole time. At the same time, he's trying to step on our throat and monopolize us and say how we're, you know, out of date. And then he'll be like, I'm a huge fan. And then he'll bring in the carcass of James Toney and have one of his MMA fighters slam him to the ground so he can say his sport is superior while kind of blocking fights where, you know, we could take a prime one of our fighters and against one of his fighters and, you know, let's do it in a boxing ring and let's see what art really works, you know. And really it is, I think, MMA versus boxing is truly styles make fights in essence, you know. But Dana's a promoter, and in my opinion, by and large, promoters are liars because they're trying to sell something to you. If something needs to be marketed to you, especially heavily, like, say, a Floyd Mayweather fight versus Amir Khan or versus Canelo or Robert Guerrero, three fights that we know, even though I think Khan, you know, take away the chin issue, does have an interesting style for Floyd, but by and large, none of those fights are truly dangerous. But Floyd will sell those to you because that's what he does. He sells you safe fights, and like Houdini, tries to convince you that he's defying death, even though he's completely in charge of the quote-unquote death trap. So Dana does the same thing. He sells you something that you really don't need, and he kind of tries to call it dangerous at the same time, or that it's, you know, the real deal, it's authentic. And sometimes it is. Some of those fights are very good in the UFC. Some of them are retread crap. Or the idea that, you know, boxing and MMA testing is the hardest in, you know, in any sport, which is just an absolute, well, it's an absolute lie, but it's just like, well, which testing are you talking about? Because there's, you know, it's a worldwide sport. Some of the countries don't even drug test, and some of the organizations aren't even used. So Dana's kind of a master of the convenient lie. So this boxing reality show, you have a really interesting take on it. On what the network should do with these things, I think it's simply an extension of that. If you can make some money off of us, he will. And, you know, if he can make a fight between, you know, somebody's grandma and you, Dave, he'll do it, you know, because that's what promoters
do. Oh, absolutely.
Do.
Right. You know, it's a money-making thing, situation. A business doesn't have a soul. The business is going to do what it needs to do in order to function, to have that bloodline. It's the people behind the business is who you have to question. I'm going to do some really quick, some self-promotion of a new series that I'm developing, which is the Boxing Blitz. I wanted to release it this week, but I still need some further gathering of information to put it all together before I release it. But, you know, some of the topics is about these boxing reality series, and I have a scheduled interview with Steve Kim tomorrow and discussing the platform of what these guys are trying to establish and what is lacking and what has been unsuccessful for these boxing reality series in the networks. But really quick, fight fans, you want to call in, you certainly can, 347-215-7598. Don't forget to download the mobile app to your Android and your iPhone. Certainly do that so that you guys can archive and you can catch like Boxeo Tijuana Radio, which is a really good podcast series that's all in Spanish. And then you also got catch up. If you miss the next round, you can still catch up to it on an archive on the mobile app. And then yours truly here, Leaving the Ring, likewise as well. Also, the other great features that we have on there, you can explore the many things that we have input onto the app so that you can able to keep contact with us and interact with other fight fans along with us. And you can see all of our Twitter accounts on there and Instagram and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So anyways, you want to call in, let's talk some boxing, 347-215-7598. A lot of boxing talk here. We got to recap some stuff. Before we hit the phone lines, I want to talk really quick about the new generation Showbox, which was a really good one, man, on the 17th. You know, I think out of all those four fights that happened on that card, the one I think that there was actually, they were, you know what, the only one that didn't really, there was really three that just really kind of stood out for me that I enjoyed. Obviously the main event was Ivan Redcatch versus Tony Lewis. And I guess I'll start off with the main event there. You know, that was a really good fight. To me, that was a very competitive fight, and that's the way matchmaking should be done. Two guys going in with both solid records. Both guys were both guys were coming to prove something, you know, to kind of leave that stage of showbox and try to move up the scale. You know, Red Catch did exactly what he's supposed to do as a tall fighter, which is fight on the outside, use that length, try to keep the distance. But it's always been proven that sometimes trying to maintain that momentum, it takes a lot. It exudes a lot of energy. You got to keep thinking, because anytime the shorter guy, he's going to do what he needs to do to get in the inside. And we saw that with Lewis, with Tony Lewis, which, you know what? Even though the win didn't sway his way, I got to tell you, Lewis impressed me. When he had the chance, he would make sure that Ivan was pushed back to the ropes. He really would rush him to kind of keep him there. And he would try to work that body so that Red Catch would stop moving, you know. And then when they were on the outside and Ivan was being able to land his punches using his height and using his distance, you would see that the momentum would sometimes change, because Tony on the outside would rush him, which would really force, you know, Red Catch, who you could see was kind of tiring out, in my opinion. He was really tiring out because of the – every time he did get cornered up, those body shots were just taking a toll. And like I said, trying to maintain that momentum of being in the outside does expend a lot of energy. So Lewis would see that, and what he would do is rush him. Rather than Red Catch try to step to the left or to the right, what he did was just go back in a straight line, and he would catch himself. And those were kind of the mistakes. You know, the scorecard was 99, 90, 97, 92, 97, 93. But you can kind of – I guess you can kind of debate that it was a little bit closer. To me, it was a little bit closer. The rounds were a little closer. I like what Lewis was doing, but he did – you know, like I said, it was in spurts. It wasn't something that was just fluent. He was having a lot of problems with the height. He was having a lot of problems when Ivan did establish the outside, you know, ground and was throwing his combinations. In the beginning of the first round, both men did touch the canvas. Mm-hmm. Where Red Catch touched the glove, but it wasn't ruled as a knockdown. But then Lewis got caught on the shoulder by Red Catch with a right hook, man, but it was a glancy one. It was like a graze right over his shoulder, but he was off balance. Lewis was off balance, and he touched the canvas. So it was a really good match. I mean, I enjoyed it. I thought that both guys proved something, and guess what? I want to see these guys back, you know, back in the ring with each other or with anybody else they decide to match them with. Gabriel?
That was the thing that really took away from the event. That fight in particular, was that both guys came away, you know, obviously Lewis got the loss and he was disappointed and they didn't feel like they lost. And in watching it, you know, because I'm doing these shows, so I have to see everything, you know, after it's already happened. And so it does take away a little bit of the drama for me. But I also kind of see the fight in a different context. And I was like, oh, well, Lewis lost. Well, let me see how it happened. And watching that first round, I thought he got a knockdown, and I didn't think that Red Catch's was a knockdown. So I thought Lewis, that was really an important swing there. But also, you know, in the fight, I felt like the announcers kept talking about it a lot, that, well, you know, Red Catch is landing the power shots, and they really talked about, like, the numbers in the fight. And, you know, I didn't really buy that. Like, you know, if people always kind of say, well, This is professional fighting, not amateur fighting, and because of that, we're going to penalize a guy for not having power, you know. And I can get that when it's like a volume puncher who's just kind of touching. Like Paul Williams early on in particular was just kind of a slap boxer. You know, he would just kind of touch you. But Lewis really put a lot into his shots, and he squares up a bit, which I think kills his power at times. His dad kept mentioning that in the fight, like, don't square up. And so he doesn't get quite the torque. But he throws, and he doesn't hurt you, but it's not for lack of trying. And there actually was a couple times where he caught, early on especially, real flush right hands on the face of Red Catch and kind of rocked him, caught him with a, you know, a left hook inside. He does know how to get shots. He's a very solid fighter. He goes to the body well. I thought he landed some very quality punches, but was kind of penalized by the announcers, at least, who did a good job, but they were penalizing him in the minds of the viewers for not having power or for not having naturally heavy hands. I thought that Redcatch, he did a good job, but very raw. For them to be saying he's going to get a world title at the end of the year and take on a Yuri Gamboa.
Yeah.
As I think Yuri Gamboa is more sizzle than steak. At the same time, he's a world-class fighter. And, you know, I mean, then again, at the same time, the guy hasn't fought all the time. I don't understand why you would target him. But it seems to me that Redcatch has a way to go before being a polished next-level fighter. But let's put them both back on Showbox against other opponents. Let's see them again. Let's see them move to the next level. But I think both guys will learn a lot from this fight. Lewis certainly learned a lot from his loss, and it showed in his bounce-back fights, and it really showed in a step-up here. I think he just tired late, and Redcatch has legitimate power. If he doesn't have that, I think Lewis is able to really take this fight over. But Redcatch caught him a few times and wobbled him. And credit to Lewis, man. That dude gets hit, and he comes back with like 3 or 4 shots. And he's a fighter, you know. He grew up doing karate. He was almost like a blue belt at age, I want to say age 8, which is pretty young to advance. I mean, he just knew early on that that's what he is. And it really shows in the fight. You know, I think both guys well in it, but I think Lewis, in some sense, came away much better because he didn't really have anything to lose. He was coming off with a loss. He was trying to rebuild and prove that he could belong at this level, whereas Redcatch was being touted as a second coming of something. And he kind of showed that he really isn't that just yet. So it was an interesting outcome, I thought, and much closer than certainly the announcers talked about. And you could almost make a case on some level, except I thought Redcatch kind of did take over late. But that final round was really a back-and-forth affair. I mean, it was just, if it had been a draw, I wouldn't have argued. I'll put it that way.
The thing that I think a lot of folks really – don't get is, like, you know, Redcatch did have he had all the signs there from previous fights of seeing that he's the taller, bigger, more lengthier fighter, but and then when you look at both guys, Tony Lewis is the shorter guy, shorter arms, and if you see the previous matches of Ivan, you think, okay, he should be able to really establish and control the way he's done in the past because he's facing a smaller guy. But here's what comes into play is that when you get a guy like Tony Lewis who comes in with determination and heart and who's going to go for it, any chance that he has the opportunity to do it, that's when the roadblock appears for a fighter that's been able to get away with his abilities, and we see that more and more. You know, for instance, we're going to be talking about Mikey Garcia a little bit on the second hour of the show because we're going to have a welterweight champion, IBF welterweight champion Sean Porter, with us to break down and give some predictions of these upcoming fights for this weekend. But just to touch on a little bit about Mikey Garcia, everybody right now has already given this kid the torch that he's going to be the next pound for pound. One of the next pound-for-pound kings, that after the Barlos fight, he should be in line because he's going to be jumping up in weight, and then hopefully there should be a Manny Pacquiao fight by the end of the year. But at the same time, I'm looking, even though he got dropped by Rocky Martinez, I'm really looking at his opposition, his line of oppositions, where they haven't tested him to the point of what do we really know about him completely, you know? The last time he was tested was by Matt, what was his name? Matt Remillard, I believe his last name was. Remillard. He was tested with Matt Remillard, but they were both still green, in my opinion. They both brought a lot to the table. They were undefeated. But see, there was not, none of them were above each other in equalness in terms of experience in the professional rankings. So when I see a guy like a Redcatch get matched correctly with a guy like Tony Lewis, to me, it's not a drop back for both men. To me, it's a gain of an experience because now you'll find out whether Redcatch can adjust to another guy that is going to probably use that playbook that Tony Lewis used and kind of tweak it to make it work for him when he does get in the ring with Redcatch, or Redcatch goes to the drawing board and says, you know what, this is everything that I did wrong, and this is everything I need to do to correct myself, and this is what I need to condition myself to make sure my game plan doesn't fall apart. Because a lot of times, even with like Tony Lewis, his game plan was to get small, his game plan was to rush. That really uses a lot of legwork. That uses a lot of muscle in your legs. So, man, a little bit more energy than normally you would do, because now you have to change up your fighting style. Now you have to change up your game plan. And that's something that all fighters and fight fans need to take note and write down, because those are the most added things that you have to look for. So when you see these guys go back into the ring, you could say, okay, how well are they going to do? Has Redcatch improved? Did he really learn from fighting Ivan? And that's why these matches like this are very important than one guy coming in, being the all-star, having the best ability, and being able to kind of mow through these guys and not learn anything out of it, but except for looking good and having fans jumping up and down saying, that was beautiful. When really, of course it was beautiful, because that's what it was set up to look like for you when it got match made.
Well, Larry Army, the manager of Ivan Redcatch, we were talking before the fight. He said, you know, sometimes you got to do this. And Bruce Trampler said this in the past too, that, you know, there comes a point, you know, you do 10 fights, 15 fights, and then you got to know what you have. You know, some of them are building fights, like, you know, this guy's got a good chin, or this guy's super slow, but he's got a dangerous punch, or whatever, different styles, different looks. But it's very rare that you kind of put your guy in at that early stage. You know, at some point, you got to put him in with a guy that has kind of all of it. And Lewis has stopped guys with the body. He's a very good body puncher. He's got sharp enough speed, we saw, but he knows how to, like, you know, pivot off an angle and then bang, come back with a shot that he can walk you into, and he can hurt you that way. He's done that in the past. That was his plan coming in, and he did it several times in the fight. And so that's what this fight was. It was a learning experience, not just for Ivan, but for the people that are handling him, so they could take a look at what they got and go from there. And I should make a correction. In my piece, I talked about him being a Ukrainian champion, and it's listed in his stats as that, but I was told by a Ukrainian boxing insider that he isn't, and he never has been. So I'm kind of looking into that and trying to get somebody in Ukrainian boxing to confirm that. But sorry about
right.
that. I kind of pulled it off of his bio and was told that, and I don't think that's true, but we'll find out about Ivan Redcatch. Another fight on the card that I was really – I'm curious, you and I haven't talked about it off air – was John Thompson versus Frank Galarza.
And that's the next fight I was talking about.
Last
yep.
week. It was a trippy fight. I didn't know how it would go. I think we were going with Thompson. But it shows that having a plan and belief in yourself and being ready sure goes a long way, man. Galarza getting him out of there in two quick rounds. That was pretty brutal.
You know what? I liked what Galarza did. Let me point out the first round really quick. You know, we got to go through this pretty quick because we got like 30 minutes before we call in the champ here on Leaving the Ring Radio. And we still got a lot of stuff to talk about. But what I didn't like what Garza did in that first round is notice his back foot. Back foot, it would lead what position where he was going to be at. That's something that their trainers really got to correct, man, because you can get a flash knockdown because your legs get crossed. It's not a good way because it indicates where you're going to lead yourself to next, you know what I mean? So if you take that back foot and you're deciding to go to the left, a smart fighter and a very thorough fighter and coach are going to see that. So they know exactly where to step to shorten their distance of punches so they can land. So Garza's got to fix that. Good for him that Thompson didn't have any time to see it, catch it, and capitalize on it. Because in the second round, after Thompson was using that beautiful jab that was working for him and keeping that distance, Garza went back and said, you know what? This guy's comfortable. He's too comfortable. And he caught it, he realized it, and he capitalized it. Came out in that first round, lands a beautiful outside, over-the-top right that catches him, stuns him, and then he finishes it with a left hook. It was a short, really short, compact left hook. Thompson never saw it. He was done. He was gone. It was a great, great win for Garza, but he's got to go back and look at that back foot. I don't know if you noticed that, Gabriel. That was the first thing that I caught on. And if I had Thompson in my corner, that's the one thing I would tell him is keep an eye on that back foot. He's going to tell you wherever place he's going to be at, so that you can counterpunch and land your punches first.
But you know, I don't know. I was always taught that you kind of think of it like a compass, like a protractor, that you do use that back foot. You're kind of sliding it. You're not telegraphing. You know, everything should be kind of moving as one. Should be able to slide and keep it so that you never cross and you never get off balance. I took it more as because the plan was to kind of check out the lay of the land, that he was tipping mentally off what he was doing. He was fighting, but he was just kind of like mapping out his territory. And yeah, it was a bit of a tell, but in the second round, he didn't do it because it was so fast. And I kind of wonder if it was just more of a byproduct of that. He was kind of laying the groundwork, kind of leading him around, seeing where he was going. But it was like you could see him thinking with that foot. You're absolutely right. But I don't have to watch
tape
to see if that's a constant tell or not, or
right.
If that was just a byproduct of the game plan, if that makes sense.
But see, here's the difference. You said slide. What Garza was doing, he was picking it up. It was a full step,
yeah.
Right. And anytime you want to map up the ground of if you're surrounding, you in boxing, you're supposed to slide that leg so that if you need to pivot immediately for urgency, you can do it, rather than planting your foot and then relifting your back heel to turn. So that's something that it's something that's starting to really just has been more and more by fighters that they're doing a lot, which they're not sliding, they're not doing the pivot, they're just lifting up the legs and stuff. So that's what I'm saying. A boxer, a slick boxer, a counterpuncher, they don't do that. And maybe Garza didn't do any of those things just because he was trying to establish that he was the puncher, and he obviously did on that second round. Some punchers don't want to slide their feet. They want to kind of stomp their ground and kind of give note that they're here and they're standing their ground because they need more of that canvas underneath the full funnel bottom of their footing to get their power. But then there's other natural power punchers that don't do that at all. They're able to punch off their back foot and front foot in any position. So it could be one of those and all that, but it was something definitely I looked at and was saying, I don't like it. I don't think you should do it.
Either way, though, they did take advantage of the fact that Thompson doesn't know how to fight going backwards, keeps that chin high up. And Galarza, he proved us wrong. I think, too, it goes back to that draw that he had with Alantes Fox, a 6'5 guy fighting at his weight class. He knows how to fight tall guys. He went a draw with him. And Alantes Fox is a quality guy, I think. It's kind of a work in progress, but and a bit of a freak in terms of physicality at that weight. But I really think that was a case of a fight going rounds and Galarza learning how to fight somebody tall and it really paying off. And, I don't want to denigrate guys that do multiple things because, I write about boxing for a living, but I'm also, working as an actor now and I have for years. But when you hear that, this guy's a painter and that's like kind of another focus of his, you kind of go, at this stage, there should only be, until you become like a master at what you're doing, you should maybe kind of focus in on the one thing, or not, not to say I'm a master, but, you got to spend 20 years with something, learn how to do it. That way you can kind of focus in on other things, So it always kind of makes me wonder. Remember there was that one boxer that was like a jazz musician as well as being a boxer, and sooner or later somebody tried to make him have that, forced him into the decision to maybe you should just go be a jazz musician instead of being both.
Right. another good fight.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, go for it. No, I was going to say, the other fight that I really, really enjoyed, and I thought it was very competitive, and it showed a lot for both fighters. To me, both of them walked away as the winner, even though it ended up on a draw, was Maurice Hooker versus Abel Ramos. That was a great fight, man.
That was a good fight. Yeah,
that was a really good fight. Yep.
Totally workmanlike, and at first I was like, oh, this guy's not that good. But he worked himself into the fight, and it showed like that kind of basic go to the body, a little bit of a jab. If he had more of a jab, I think that he would have taken Hooker apart a little bit more, particularly late when he was really starting to come on. Ramos just, he was winging it, winging too many punches, and he could have negated what Hooker was doing, kind of put him into one spot, you know, a jab to the chest, maybe a, you know, jab upstairs, jab to the chest, kind of stun him into place, and then come across with those sweeping shots. Instead, he was wasting a lot of energy just going for the sweeping shots, trying to do the bob and weave and then hooking. But, you know, I always like what Jose Luis Castillo did with Floyd and in many of his fights. He had a really sneaky jab as he would kind of like dip and then come with that jab to the chest and then bring in, you know, other shots over the top or around the side. That said, you know, I liked Hooker. I wonder if his punch resistance and how his toughness in a fight, how long he'll – if, you know, if Ramos had more power, he's going to have some problems. You know, he's a big guy making that weight. And while they're looking for the height and strength advantages, I always kind of wonder what they're sacrificing in that. But heck of a fight, man.
You know, Hooker was doing his thing from the first and second. That third round, though, I think that's where he started letting things slip away. He stopped fighting from the outside, and he started allowing Ramos to come in that inside. You know, the thing with the overhand that was wild punches is those punches really do work and land with the taller guy. But here's the thing. You got to set those punches up with another punch, the jab like you just mentioned. But the one that really would set it up is the jab to the belly. We've seen guys like Pernell Whitaker was phenomenal for doing something like that. He always jabbed to that belly to shorten you down a little bit, you know, and made you cautious, you know, because after maybe 5 or 10 nicely placed jabs to the belly, it starts making you now trying to catch the glove. And then that sets up that over the top and punch, you know. So if you remember, too, like with Juanma Marquez, he would jab to the belly with Manny Pacquiao, and then he would throw over the top. You know, it's the way to set it up. And I think that's what Ramos's camp and a lot of other fighters that try to throw that overhand wild shot to get over the gloves of the taller guy, they need to remember, they got to set it up. You just can't throw it. Sometimes it works by just throwing it, and it's going to land. You can get lucky. But in boxing, we always say this, there's never a lucky punch. It's a setup punch that gets you the money shot. And that's what Ramos has to do. I mean, they both did a fantastic job. They both were going back and forth. Each round was going back and forth. Ramos started coming on really late. But was I mad about the draw? Absolutely not. I thought they both gained a lot by learning from each other. And I think that both guys are going to go off and do some bigger and better things away with this fight. Sometimes a fight like that is educational, and you got to walk away thinking that, you know what, I just came out of a really good class, a good seminar of learning how to fight and learning how to adjust and what I need to do when I go back to that drawing board to kind of now add a little bit more patenting clay to my ability. So that goes there for that fight there, man. On
this
the solo
book.
Oh, you want to talk about that one? Put everybody back to sleep.
The Antoine Douglas versus Marquise Davis.
One-sided.
He's kind of Kirkland Light, you know. He
right.
goes all in. He throws a lot of punches, too many punches. Like Kirkland, why I call him Kirkland Light is because he has all the punches, he has the intensity. But what Kirkland does is really hit you with some damaging shots, and he really gets in there. But the thing that with Kirkland is he's not only throwing a lot of punches, but there's a high intensity to what he does. There's a sense of urgency. That's much in the Molina fight where he was basically like Antoine Douglas, trying to throw a lot of shots and it was not all there. You know, he was kind of missing that energetic intensity. Whereas in his last fight with Tapia, it's like he's just all over you, and he's super fast and moving and going, you know, dude, we're doing Hagler Hearns whether you like it or not. With this Douglas kid, there's just kind of too much confidence. I know he's a lot of guys are high on him in the industry, and I do think he has room to grow, and he's got all the tools. You know, there's something to be said for quality over quantity. And I think he would be better served setting up the jab a little bit, being a little more conventional. Yeah, be that aggressive. I love aggression like that, and I love that all-in mentality. But against a guy that can withstand that and turn you a little bit and make you move and make you miss a little bit and kind of weather your storm or, you know, in doing so, he's going to have problems late. And I got to say it, I know everybody's got their different way of what they do when they punch, but, man, I don't want to hear for the rest of his career, bop, 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 bop. I don't like it with Broner. I don't like it with him. I think it's just really annoying. Like, you know, we talk about guys that are TV friendly. That is really annoying on the ears. That whole bop, bop, bop. I think you're fooling yourself to think that you're hitting harder than you are. You know, I know there's the ki in karate and everything where you're kind of focusing it with a sound, but boy,
right.
That sounds annoying, dude. It just really drives me crazy. And I just think when he started to move and box later on in the fight, I was like, man, that's what you should do. Get some space. Let this guy come to you, you know, and learn to do the off-speed pitch that set something up. I remember talking to Kirkland early on in his career, and he was like, I'm just now barely getting to the place where I know how to pick and pack, where it's like, you know, you kind of touch, bang. You mix in something hard. And, you know, hopefully if he kind of returns back to his peak in a couple fights, he'll get that back into his game. But you saw it at the top of the fight where he would just kind of be touching, and then whang, there would be this hard shot. That's what this kid needs to learn. I think with some seasoning and with some humility in terms of looking at his own tape and going, you know what, I didn't just win and knock this guy's teeth out and all that, which was pretty depressing. He needs to learn how to the off-speed pitch. And also to use his other attributes, which is a nice jab. He's got a lot of great tools, but I think he's just kind of misusing them a little bit. So, again, that's what Showbox was about. I thought it was an excellent card. It was nice to see that we didn't get the kind of one-sided, you know, money team kind of favor fights. Instead, you know, we got some quality and we got some crossroads stuff. Showbox got back to its original mission. Good stuff.
Absolutely. On Solo Boxeo, you had that super flyweight, David Sanchez versus Marco Di Micilio. I don't know if you watched that one. That was actually a really good, entertaining fight. It only went four rounds, but from the beginning to that ending, a left hook that was landed on Di Micilio. Before that, we had a really competitive match. You know, Sanchez was being the boxer. And Decimio was being the stalker. And you know what I liked what Sanchez was doing? And a lot of times you don't see a lot of Latinos doing this. You're starting to see a little bit more and more and more. But having movement, and with that movement, having some boxing skills along with it. And he was throwing some really nice combinations, both those guys. Anytime they got in close, they both were throwing some polished combinations. You know, they were sweeping from the body back to the head. What Sanchez was doing, I thought it was fantastic, was after he would jab, what he would do, anytime he was moving and he decided to stop, he didn't stop and look for an opening. He stopped and created an opening with the jab, and then he always finished it with an uppercut. And then it just took its toll. This seemingly was trying to work the body, was trying to slow down Sanchez from throwing all those punches when he stopped his movement. But it just later caught on to him, you know, where, you know, when Sanchez said, okay, enough's enough, my movement is here, now what I'm going to do is continue moving, but I'm going to move in a certain type of way where I start cutting that ring off and start pushing him back. And that's exactly what he did. And guess what? Di Micilio got caught up on those ropes, and he got caught up with a bunch of flurries from Sanchez, which was Sanchez turned the tide. He started throwing a lot of body shots, and then when he decided to take a step back, he let a really nice, clean left hook, and it just landed perfect. Dropped him, and it just ended on the TKO there from the referee waving it off, man. I don't know if you guys had a chance to watch that. I thought it was a great fight, a great matchup between both guys.
Yeah, I thought it was an excellent stoppage, too. I mean, it was just right on the money. You didn't need to go any further to get that fall back down. That was just a nice fight, you know, and it's a constant reminder that we overlooked the little guys, man.
Yeah,
it'd be nice
big
to
time.
See HBO and Showtime invest in these guys just a little bit. You know, these are good fights, and they're generally action fights. Every time I see the little guys fight, I'm not disappointed. You know, whereas we saw some heavyweight fights we'll talk about. Mike Perez, you know, Carlos Takam, that fight, man, I was just like, this is. I mean, it was okay. There was some drama, and then it was a bit of an upset that I thought was happening. But, you know, we're so stuck on the glamour division that we're really missing, you know, the all-action division, you know, in the lower weight classes. It's kind of a bummer.
Yeah, big time. Fight fans, we're going to open up the phone lines in just about maybe 5 minutes, 347-215-7598. Don't forget to download the app to tune into all the rest of the shows, like the Boxing Blitz to Boxeo Tijuana Radio, and also the next round with Steve Kim and Mr. Truly Yours truly here, the Dark Cloud, Gabriel Montoya. Hey, I want to talk about – let's talk about Mike Perez here for a bit. You know, a lot of fight fans were kind of downing on the guy because they were expecting him to come out and be that force that he was
Carlos, you're talking about Magomed.
Yeah, Magomed. And a lot of guys were – a lot of fans were expecting, even the commentators were expecting him to come out in that type of forceful style. But I think a lot of people forget that styles make fights. When you got a guy like Mike Perez, who's a Cuban fighter, and you know their style is not to really engage, but when you get another fighter that wants to engage and forces you to engage, you're going to get the best out of them because it's a survival tactic. They're going to fight back. But with the Carlos Takan fight, you didn't really get that because, this, like I said, styles make fights. You're not always going to get the Mike Perez that we witnessed in the past, too. And then, too, with the headbutt, here's my take with the headbutt, because some folks are saying the whole Maggo thing, it came into play. That could have took away from him. And you're absolutely right, man. When you do damage to another guy and a guy goes into a coma, self a coma, it's going to do something to you. But it also causes you, it puts a caution in your life and in your profession. Here's a headbutt. It's got a good gash. And you got to think there for a moment. Maybe he started thinking like, hey, you know what? I don't want to get my position where I go into a coma. I kind of want to prolong my career. I think that's where some reserve came in. I think numerous things came into play when he was in the ring with Takan. I think that was just not one sole thing. I don't know what your thoughts about that, Gabriel.
You know, I thought there was a lot there. I mean, I agree with you that here's the thing. You know, and I talked about this on TNR on Monday, and you can download the app, the Leaving in the Ring Boxing app, to hear that episode, or you can check out our Facebook pages and all that stuff. Magomed was never a defensive genius, but he's also very aggressive. If you watch all his fights, they're all like that. They're all brutal.
Right.
Wars. People kept saying, oh, well, you know, the corner should have stopped it and this and that and the other thing, because he's getting hit a lot. I'm like, have you not watched all his other fights? Because they're all like this. He gets hit a lot. Even in like against lesser guys, he gets hit a lot. And so I think that made, because it was easier for him to be hit, I think it made Mike Perez look like a much more of an action fighter than he really is. It got good to him. And he was able to go out there and he kept trying to get this guy out of there because he was just hitting him flush and figured it's going to go away at some point. And he didn't. But in this fight, I thought what happened with Mago, I think you're right. You know, I think he was thinking about it. But I also think, you know, like he was thinking about it in terms of, I don't want to hurt the other guy. You know, the finishing instinct, he might have some pause now. But also, I think for himself, he's starting to think, you know, worrying a little bit, you know, what's going to happen to me?
I think I can end up too. I can end up in that position as well. Yep.
But I also think that, you know, Tom is a guy that we don't really know much about. And there's the third possibility that he might just be a little bit better than we think. And he had some good power, got some really good body shots, was coming on later. That's the second possibility. And so maybe there was a little bit of that, which I think the fight bears that out as being truthful. But also, you know, I was just looking at kind of how sluggish Perez seemed at times. And granted, the headbutt happened early, and he even told the HBO said it on the broadcast. He told his coach, you know, after the eighth round, like, I don't really know what's wrong with me. I just don't feel right. And in talking with guys, you know, kind of one of my, not the hobbies, but one of the angles I cover in the sport is the conditioning coaches and learning about it. And recently I didn't release the video because I don't need the derision, but I did a test for myself. Some of the videos I've been doing with like Bruno Escalante and Stan Martianuk, a couple other fighters. I don't think I got video of Sean Porter doing it, but this hypoxic boxing training, and I watched Amir Khan do it as well. And it's like a simulates high altitude using this hypoxicator, which kind of restricts, you know, the oxygen, and it gets you down to like 80% oxygen. That's what the goal is, and everybody's kind of different. And it's this study that they're doing over at Undisputed, based on a lot of research. That's come out, I think, last March. I've done some videos on it, and you can just look up hypoxic boxing training, and there's three or four videos about it explaining it. And what they're finding, and Gavin McMillan, who trains Cotto and Provodnikov, he believes this too, that the idea that training high and living high is kind of a misnomer, and that it actually kind of works against you. It makes it harder to sleep, which is where you get your recovery. It also, not everybody's the same. Like I noticed, you know, everybody's got a different reading. Like what that 80%, what they figured out with the hypoxicator and the training is the goal. You want to get everybody to 80% oxygenation and that, or 80% blood oxygen level. And that could be different for you and me. You could get there at 8,000 feet. I personally get there somewhere around 12,000 feet. And that's really the target. Now, if you're living in Big Bear or any other altitude, you know, it's like 7,000 feet, something like that. Well, everybody's going to be different, and there's no way to really adjust it, and you're just there all the time. So you adjust to it, and then you've got to move down to regular altitude, probably like maybe 10 to 14 days out, because there's a dead period where you, for 7 days, you kind of are flat, and then the benefits kind of return heading into that second week, and then you're peaking. So you really got to time it correctly. It's not as scientifically exact. And so what the research is showing is that that misnomer of like living in the mountains, that that actually does anything for you that is exact if you don't time it right. And everybody's different. Your 80% right. is going to be different than my 80%. So when I was watching Mike Perez, I was kind of like, he looked flat to me. And I'm wondering, since he's now training up there and it's kind of newer to him, a couple fights, it's a bit of, you know, Russian roulette is maybe not a bad analogy, but it's a bit of a gamble. Sometimes it's going to work. Sometimes it's not, and there's a lot of other factors that come into play. So that's a little bit of too much science, but check out the videos, and you'll see what I'm talking about.
Well, you also got to think, too.
I kind of watched that.
You also got to think, too, that air gets thinner up there, that your lungs got to adjust to it. So they're working a little harder to get air in your body and in your brain. So your body's working. You're obviously working to gain that extra stamina. You're working to get that extra out of yourself in the ring. But if you don't give yourself time to adjust to it, adapt to it, it's gonna have its effect. But you know what, fight fans, let's pat some fight fans on before we get into Sean Pascal and Lucien Boutte. Let's get some fight takes from some of the listeners out there. So let's go with. Area code 860, you're on live right now on Leaving the Ring. What's on your mind?
Yo, it's Rob out here in Connecticut right now.
What's up, man? Connecticut, huh?
Yeah, too cold up here. I should have stayed in Puerto Rico. yeah, I just wanted to brush you a few things. I've been gone for like a minute unboxing, and like I came back, I think it was two nights ago, just started watching 24 hours of what I missed, just straight up boxing fight after boxing fight. I like how the officiating is getting a little bit more strict on the clinching. The Sean Porter fight, I like how they didn't allow the clinching. They let them fight a little bit. I like that in the Adrian Broner fight. The clinching was limited. You know, I hope to see that in the future with Danny Garcia's fights, because I can't stand his clinching whenever he gets rocked or whenever he's tired. His clinching is ridiculous. And Andre Ward. Yo, 15 rounds need to come back. I was waiting for the Lucien Boutte fight to set off, and it sets off in the last 30 seconds, and it's like, no, not now, don't answer, you know. Oh, my God. I was, like, mad excited. I'm, like, bored the whole fight, and this whole, and then, you know, Pascal's getting rocked at the end, and I'm like, no, don't, no, 15 rounds.
I don't care what he says. He was not doing that because he wanted to set up a rematch. He was exhausted.
Yeah, he was tired.
He was tired in the 11th as well, and he kind of exploded and missed a lot. You know, it was a case of, like, one guy did little, the other guy did less that fight. I was not impressed.
I think it has to do with his balance. I mean, like, he has the Andre Berto feet where, like, he, you know, he throws punches, and for some reason he's tippy-toeing like a ballerina whenever he's throwing punches. It's like, I don't even know where they allow that to be, like, you would think your trainer would tell you something about that and try to, you know, train you to not lose your balance so much. But
who's that? What are we talking about? About Pascal?
Pascal. Yeah.
Yeah, like, yeah, I was actually going to mention that, how he throws his combinations, and no matter what, he always falls forward.
Yeah.
Know?
And I'm surprised Boutte didn't apply the pressure earlier. Like throughout the whole fight, Boutte stepped forward, would throw that simple 1-2, and it seems like his – speed was a lot faster. Like, his size, it looked like it was okay. His chin held up better. And every time he would throw that 1-2, it would always land. And in the final round, and also body work, I'm surprised he wasn't being aggressive toward Pascal's body, because Pascal's not the type of dude, like you said, his balance. He's not the type of dude who's just going to, you know, take a step back and just whop you in the, you know, with an uppercut or, like, you know, land an overhand. He's just, he needs his balance, and he needs to get the jump first to throw combinations. So
he's a guy that you need
to I kind of wondered if he freaked it. Well, one, nobody's really saying, hey, the guy's been off for a year, so he's rusty.
Right.
But, and he's coming off an injury to his hand, so he's not really that confident in it. But also, you know, he made such a big deal about getting that drug testing done, getting Pascal in a testing program, and they were going to do it at a certain time, and then he got injured, so it got postponed. I have thought, you know, I'm not trying to, I mean, they're in their testing program, so I'm not going to sit there and throw aspersions on Pascal. I don't think that's fair. He complied. They wanted to do it. He's doing it. But at the same time, because it was such a big deal, I couldn't help but think Butte had freaked himself out a little bit. And when you go to the body, you risk getting hit to the head. And you could see Pascal really wanted to land that left hook, and they even set it in the corner. Land the special left hook, you know, when he was trying to, like, explode and land it and end things. So I kind of wondered if that, if he gave himself fear where he didn't need to have it.
No, you know what? Yeah. I mean, you know what? That could be one reason. But you know what? My whole thought with through that whole fight is, I mean, look at the opposition that Lucien Butte has fought in the past. I mean, when's the last time he's a southpaw? When's the last time you saw him fight an orthodox that had the speed that Pascal had? I think that really puzzled him a bit. He looked really tense, man. And I think that layoff had a lot to do with it, because it was almost like he needed to shake off the ring rust, and it was shaking it off a guy that if you don't break his rhythm, he's gonna be all over the place. He's gonna establish his speed. He's gonna establish his combinations, and Butte didn't know what to do with that because he's never been in that position before. I mean, I gotta be honest with you guys. I thought I questioned Butte's resume way back, and even when I picked Carl Frotz, I said, you know, I think Carl Frotz shook off the nerves with Ward, and he's going to go in there and prove the Cobra's still around, and he did. He struck, and he made exactly what I had always thought about Butte, which was a guy with a padded record and had a really good, always against subpar opponents, and I think now that we're seeing him step up a level. Yeah.
People always would say that, you know, the best super middleweight is not in the super six, and I would say, nope. That is, he is Sven Butte or Lucien Otke. That's how I always kind of looked at him, is that a guy that had a good record, but if you look deeper, it wasn't that great. He got guys at the right time, and he was a great business. He didn't need to go anywhere. I completely 100% disagree with Virgil Hunter and Andre Ward and their decision not to go to Montreal and just finish the job at 168. Why they didn't do that and why Hunter still kind of justifies, see, you know, Carl beat him, and we beat Carl. So it doesn't work like that. You don't get a W for what somebody else did.
Absolutely.
And it'll never make sense to me to not go up there, get the ratings, get the exposure to those fans, and get the respect of all boxing fans for cleaning out the division. The only thing I could think of is if they'd clean it out, they'd have to move up. And they can keep claiming nobody wants to fight Andre at 68. It's like, dude, you fought everybody.
I think it's just bad matchmaking, to be honest. I think Lucien Butte should not have taken a fight with Jean Pascal, even off of the layoff in the injury, off of a Carl Froch fight, knockout loss. I don't think Pascal's the guy you fight regardless, because there's too many questions you're going to have going into your next fight, no matter who it is. And, you know, Pascal is not the dude you want to step into the ring with questions. And now we're going to have to probably see Butte against Chad Dawson. Not that that's a bad matchup, but, I mean, like, you know, that's probably the only thing I could see Butte doing to try to reestablish his career, somewhat like I could see Adrian Broner fighting Sean Porter, maybe, or Adrian Broner against, you know, I don't think he's going to get the Maidana rematch off the bat. Maybe Adrian Broner against Garcia or something like that to set up some type of link bout between Maidana and Garcia. I don't know, but, you know, there's a whole bunch of matchups coming out right now that are possibilities. So, I don't know, it's just matchmaking right now, and I just hope that the matchmaking doesn't get let go, because this Canelo-Angulo fight is rubbish. That is ridiculous. I don't know. I don't know what this is. I don't think both guys should do this. Whoever loses this fight, their career is basically done for. And especially for Canelo, I don't care about, you know, Virgil Hunter went off in that interview all salty and stuff because he was getting all questioned. But, you know, he was, like, trying to deny the dudes, you know, his questions and stuff like all trainers do. Fighters do the same thing. You know, they live in a fairy tale world where, you know, if their fighter loses, their fighter's still relevant. No. Either fighter who loses here, especially Canelo, if Canelo loses to Angulo, that's it. His career is done. Nobody's going to care. Nobody wants to hear about a pretty boy kid that loses to Angulo. So,
yeah.
I don't know. Boxing's looking pretty strong right now. It's looking pretty strong right now, but it's kind of like amber right now. It hasn't hit the flame yet, but the ambers are there.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I thought Hunter was pretty out of line in the interview, to be honest. I thought he was arrogant. I thought he wasn't open-minded at all. And there's no perception that Amir Khan has been knocked out. Those are facts. He's been stopped. He's been stopped by guys that are lesser than Floyd Mayweather. That's a fact. He's never fought at 147 pounds. That's another fact. And it's also a fact that since this fight has been mentioned, there's been a couple guys, myself included, that have said, you know, and even Steve Kim has said, you know, it's an interesting style matchup, regardless of the losses and the chin or the punch resistance of Khan. It's an interesting style matchup for Floyd because he's never fought a guy that would be willing to just kind of box and move and have size and speed in that. And Amir, I've seen him in the gym plenty of times. He's very, very fast. But he gets knocked out. He's been knocked out by lesser dudes. So when this idea of perception that Hunter tries to throw out, and I'm sorry, but sometimes perception is actually reality. That's a phrase, and it's because it's true. The perception that I'm getting from the fans is they're not interested in this fight. And that's just, you know, I don't think Raheem was out of line. In fact, I thought he did almost too much of a good job of rephrasing the question to try to calm Hunter down. I think Hunter was more mad that Raheem works for Max Boxing than anything.
That's what it was.
That's what it was.
That's what it was. I mean,
he took shots at Steve Kim on Fight Hype, saying, oh, you still live, you know, this guy that lives in, he wouldn't say Steve's name. Very cowardly act, in my opinion, and saying, well, this guy, you know, a guy that lives in his basement with his mother, this, that, and the other thing. Well, you know, in certain cultures, actually, living with your parents and taking care of them in their old age is part of the culture, and it's nothing dishonorable about it. I'm not going to sit here and talk about Steve's business, but to call him that is just cowardly. It's hypocritical, and it's just flat out wrong. Hunter
Absolutely.
Needs to man up. Actually name some names sometime. And he also needs to get a little humble and get off his high horse about philosophy. We could debate reality any day of the week or perception. But those things weren't about perception, what Raheem was asking about. He was being a reporter, and he was reflecting what the fans are feeling and taking the sample size of it. I thought he was dead on the money. I thought Hunter owes Raheem an apology. That's
you know, just me. I said this a long time ago. I believe it was last year when he was picking up all these fighters in the stable. I said I thought he was biting a little bit too much, you know, for him to handle. And you know what? The pressure of having different fighters, the criticism is going to come from every angle. And I think that's what's happening with Virgil Hunter right now is he has to deliver. He was voted as Trainer of the Year. He was really applauded of what he was doing with Andre Ward. But when you start taking other fighters with really not – it has nothing to do with the similarities of the fighter you work with, you're going to get some major criticism when they're not performing the way that people think they should because they have you now on in their corner. You could tell Virgil's not one of those guys that likes to receive criticism. He likes to be in control. And sometimes I love to hear his philosophy, but sometimes it can turn into a ramble where he just likes to hear himself talk. We need to call in Sean Porter, the IBF champion, and also he's the 50th guy to win a world title coming off of a Showbox Generation Series. So that's something else there that that even Ken was letting me know about. He was telling me about, and I thought that was pretty cool. So, fight fans, if you want to call in 347-215-7598. You're going to have a chance to ask Sean Porter any questions you guys want because this is going to be – he's coming on as not really as a guest, more like a host because he's going to be breaking down this week in fights. He's going to touch on a little bit about last week's fight. I mean, I like to hear his take about Pascal and Boutte, and where does Pascal go from here?
It's going to be fun stuff. Is he called in? Is he on the line, or is he going to be calling me? I think they might be calling me, and I'll patch him in. I'm not sure.
No, I'm going to be calling them in.
Okay. Sorry to go on a little bit of a rant there, but, you know, I'm kind of tired of the and people kind of complained last week that we didn't name names. And so in this case, you know, I'll take that criticism and just say, you know, I think that's – like the Andre Ward put out a tweet this week. And I don't know – you know, Andre and I talked. A lot of people think, oh, you'd never say any of this stuff to Andre's face. We talked after my last article on him came out. He called me. We talked. I have no problem going right at people on Twitter. And I'm not a passive-aggressive person. I wouldn't necessarily categorize me as aggressive, but, you know, if I have something to say, I'm going to say it.
Hello?
And,
hello? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Who do I have here? Do I have Ken Porter or Sean Porter with me?
You got Ken Porter. Sean is right here as well. How's the connection? How are we sounding?
You guys are sounding good, man. Hey, thanks for taking the time to talk to us here on Leaving the Ring Radio. I really appreciate you guys coming through as a guest host here for the beginning of our first year back on the air on Leaving the Ring.
Well, thank you for having us. Greatly appreciate the invitation.
Gabe, we want to give the grand introduction of both gentlemen that are with us here on Leaving the Ring.
Well, you know, first off, we have the newly crowned, and he crowned himself by ripping that belt off and putting it on around his own waist through a hell of a fight, IBF welterweight champion Sean Porter, and the loquacious trainer and father of Sean, Mr. Ken Porter, who I always enjoy speaking the fights with. So welcome both of you to the show. Really just thank you for taking the time to do this experiment with us. It's kind of something new that we've done. That's not kind of something new. It is something new. So let us proceed.
Okay. Well, as Muhammad Ali said, if loquacious is good looking, then that's me.
Talk about we're gonna do a little bit of a mini view at the beginning of this because we haven't had a chance to talk since you guys won the belt together. And I have to watch that training camp fight I don't call it a sparring session, it was a fight with James Kirkland.
It was a fight.
I considered it a turning point for Kirkland, certainly, because the next day he went back to Ann Wolf and finished off his training and was successful in doing so. Would you guys consider that moment a turning point, or just kind of a level up moment, or just like this is where we are and it was just a positive experience. Can you talk about that experience for both of you guys?
Yeah. Hey, guys, this is Sean Porter here to answer that question for you. Myself, I believe in that you always have to prove things to yourself, not only in fights but also in training, especially in training more than the fight. And I think in that sparring session, a.k.a. fight, one thing I proved to myself is that I have what it takes no matter what. No matter what's hurting, no matter what's going on, whether that be in the ring or in the corner, I have what it takes to stay focused and achieve whatever goals I may have at that point in time. And at that point in time, it was really just about getting some awesome work from a good fighter, a solid, tough fighter. And I proved myself that I have what it takes to stand in there with arguably one of the toughest fighters in the game right now. And so, you know, taking that into the fight against Devin Alexander was great for me.
Let me ask Ken Porter a question here, because after that win, obviously a lot of folks were ready putting you guys into that Mayweather sweepstakes. As a trainer, and you know your son, you know, you've been working with them from the get-go, do you look at it like the Alexander win as, yeah, that's the fight that we needed in order to kind of signify to everybody that we're ready for the step up with Floyd Mayweather, that we should get that fight as the next bout? Or do you look at it and say, like, slow down, you know, fans, and slow down writers and everybody else, commentators, let my son gradually build himself up and get him to that point where it's a demand now, not just a mention of name, but a demand that he needs to get in the ring with Floyd Mayweather?
Oh, okay. Well, Ken left. Loquacious is here.
Go ahead.
And, right. Loquacious Porter, sir. To answer that question for you, I don't really consider that a turning point, but it was another step up in everything we were doing in the camp. And the fight with Devin, I don't really – obviously that was a turning point in his career, but I look at it more, and I'm imposing this upon Sean. He's now 1-0 as a professional. So we got a lot of work to do in every area. In every area that we, you know, in preparation for everything we do, he's just 1-0 as a professional, as far as I'm concerned. And I have not heard any conversations. This is the first time I heard anything being said about Sean being in the Mayweather sweepstakes. I don't think that's even something that has really been considered on their end. I haven't heard anything about it. As far as where we're going from here, you know, I don't think there's any reason to step back. I would like to step up higher than Devin, you know, challenge him, challenge myself as a coach. So, you know, no, there's no reason to sit pat at all. You know, we want to work hard and set goals. And in order to, you know, achieve those goals, we got to have something in front of us challenging us.
Absolutely. I like the answer. Beautiful. So let's
well, this is one more. You guys, in prepping for that fight, you went in search of the most badass guys you could find. You got in there with CP, you know, Chris Pearson, and he went on to win his fight. Demetrius Andrade, or Andre, I keep screwing up his last name, he went on to win a title. Kirkland quickly realized he was not as prepared as he thought he was, went back to Anwolf, beat up Borgman Tapia. What is it that you guys are doing? You know, and what is it? Was it mission accomplished? I guess because you went off and won your title, are you going to approach all the fights? You know, the second fight of your pro career, the same way, and like looking out for the top guys to go in there and push yourself against. Was that a strategy that just kind of happened, or was it something that you planned? Like, we're going to go and get the best dudes and find guys that are on that cusp of success or super hungry in order to challenge ourselves against in camp.
And these guys were well polished and fast. It's not like you guys went after bigger guys that were going to be slow and methodical, man. That's what I thought was very impressive and on the route you guys took on doing that.
Well, let me ask a part of it and then I'll turn it over to Sean as well. As far as that's concerned, that's the way I prepare for every fight and have always prepared that way. Even in the amateurs, you know, we would go to Colorado Springs for the U.S. Championships, but we would be in Colorado. I would rent an apartment, you know, a month before that to, you know, prepare for everything that we dealt with there. We would go and we would, you know, spar the guys from the Army team, and we would, you know, climb mountains and do anything and everything we could to be prepared so that, you know, if we came up short, we'd still be on the top somewhere. So that's what we've always done. And I always say, well, man, I don't know how we going to top that last camp, but I'll find a way to do it. It's, you know, that's just – I refuse to be our coach. That's not going to happen. I refuse. Those guys that we brought in, Chris Pearson, he was tremendous in every way, from every standpoint. He was a huge, huge part of Sean's success. As a person, as a boxer, I mean, he did everything. It was even times he was, you know, in the ring with Sean and he was coaching Sean, you know. So he did, you know, he's a young fighter, but he's been in it for quite a long time as an amateur and now young in his professional career, but doing very well. And I'm glad to see he was successful. I was jumping around when he was having his fight. And, you know, we continue to, you know, with Demetrius Andrade bringing him in. Obviously, he had just won a world championship probably within 2 weeks before we brought him in. And so him and Sean went about 28 rounds. And then, of course, you know, there was the moments that we had with James Kirkland. That was great. So, you know, this is what we've always done and continue to do, and we'll have to do again in preparation for the next fight that we have coming up. As soon as they tell us who that might be, I'm going to turn it over to Sean.
Hey, guys. Yeah, just to kind of mimic what my dad said, I'll say it a different way. We don't believe in being prepared for matches. We believe in being over-prepared for matches. So with that being said, I understand the goals that are set day in and day out, the things that we want to accomplish in the ring, in our training sessions day in and day out. And I'm used to my dad bringing in the toughest, the best, the fastest, the strongest, the quickest, the biggest, to push me, to raise my competition level. That way when I get into the fight, you know, it's we've already been there, already done that in a sense. So every training camp, we push ourselves to our limits. And I think coming into that fight against Devin Alexander, we were just over-prepared. We were more than prepared for anything he had to bring, and, you know, we made that happen that night.
You guys certainly did, man. I got to tell you that. We're going to roll in about I want to talk a little bit about Sean Pascal and Lucian Bute. And you guys can jump in whenever you guys feel like it and put your input about what we're talking about these fights. And then we're going to talk a little bit about the upcoming fights this weekend with Mikey Garcia and Juan Carlos Barrios. Going back with Sean Pascal, you know, what I noticed with Sean Pascal is that if you don't break that rhythm, and I was mentioning this a little earlier, if you don't break that rhythm of him, he's just going to continue doing what he's doing. I know there's been some comparisons of Roy Jones. I don't really see that, man. I don't know about you, Gabriel, but I'm one of those guys just shaking my head saying there's a little glimpse of him, but to kind of put that label, that full label frontal of Roy Jones on his back, I think it's just one of those things where you hear like Max Kellerman always labeling everybody as a Pernell Whitaker, man. I don't know why. I always cringe and say stop bringing up the greats with these guys and just allow them to kind of form who they are.
Yeah, I just don't see it. And then Roy is incredibly technically flawed. As soon as he started to slow down, that's what we saw. He's a very smart fighter, but he's not Ali. Ali was able to be an original but also adjust as he got older and learn how to be a little more, well, not defensive, but he could take a good punch and lure you in with tactics. Roy has not shown that ability. He's just kind of fell right off the cliff as opposed to rolling downhill slowly. Pascal is, I wouldn't even call him a poor man's Roy Jones so much as a destitute Roy Jones. What do you guys think?
You know what? I kind of feel the same way as you guys did. As he stated at the beginning of his statement when he said that you have to break John Pascal's rhythm. Bute didn't do that. He got into his rhythm and, you know, the fight went on as it did. But at the same time, the guy is by far, he's no means a Roy Jones Jr. at all. He's too thick to be as quick or as fast as Roy Jones was. We did see a glimpse of the things that Roy used to do back in his day, putting the hands down, throwing the feints, you know,
right,
the up jab, the quick punches and the turns and stuff like that. But at the same time, like you said, me being a young fighter, I kind of don't want to be compared to anyone. I like to come into my own. I like to one day be known as Sean Porter, the best fighter that he could be, not Sean Porter, who looked like such and such, you know. So from that standpoint, John Pascal did a good job that night, but Roy Jones Jr., no, sir.
you know what? I'm glad that you said that, because I think a lot of fighters, some fighters, when they're coming up in the rankings, you know, when they start off, they want to be like, oh, well, I try to mimic this guy's style. I want to be like Julio Cesar Chavez. I want to be like Floyd Mayweather. But I think later on when you start getting up there, you don't want to be labeled like that, because then they kind of now – you kind of fall into the cracks of the shadow of the other fighter, and you don't get the recognition, and you don't get that stamp of being a great fighter. But let me ask you this, you know, being a fighter, is Sean Pascal, every time he throws a punch, we were talking about this earlier with a caller, every time he throws a combination, his footwork is so bad that he always falls forward. What do you think is the problem? What's going on there, do you think? Because it's something that he's never corrected in his career so far.
Exactly. It's something that he's never corrected. And along with that is it's worked for him up to this point, you know. If something doesn't work, you're going to try it a different way. But he's just falling into something that he's made his own. It worked for him. It doesn't look too good, you know, especially against, you know, good fighters, but it's worked for him. I think that he overcommits. I think that he tries to throw too fast too soon, and he tries to throw in combination multiple punches at one time, and it just, in a lot of ways, it doesn't look good. I saw points in the fight against Boutte where it looked good, and I kind of smiled. I laughed a little bit, and then there were also points where I was just like, why are you doing that, you know? So, but again, right. he's made that his own. Yeah, he's made that his own, and, you know, it's got him this far. So, you know, to a extent, I can't knock it.
No, I agree with you. Yeah, I think to a extent, you can't knock it, but it's definitely – I think with Bernard Hopkins, remember that first fight, and then the second one, Bernard went back to what Hopkins always does, which is be that counterpuncher. But what he did to me, in my opinion, so that Pascal couldn't try to be as fast was he's the one that set the pace by going after him immediately. But then occasionally what he would do is let Pascal be himself, and then he would take that little extra inch back to counter him. And that's what worked, you know. And I think that's what other fighters right now, they should look at when watching Pascal fights is how he falls forward and how he overcommits, just like you said, how he overcommits and how they can capitalize on that overcommitment.
Yeah, you got to be able to capitalize on things like that. And like you said, I think that's a good strategy that Bernard used. It's a mind game, you know. It makes you feel like, I can't do what I want to do, and then it makes you feel like, oh, he's going to let me do what I want to do. But, you know, and that's boxing. I don't think if you haven't been in the ring, if you haven't experienced boxing to that point, then you really wouldn't understand. But boxing is, you know, like everyone says, just as much mental as it is physical. So there were points in my fight with Devin that, you know, I made him feel like he could come forward on me just to get him where I wanted him to be. You know, I didn't want him to retreat. I didn't want him to be able to counter me. So there were points where I tried to use a mind game, come at me, attack me. You think you can, and then watch what I do, you know. So Bernard is all about the mind games. We know that, and, you know, it worked that time against John Pascal.
Speaking about mind games, and this is a question for both of you guys here, man, because you guys are in that position. Something that's always been very political, I guess you could say, correct with fighters. After a fight, they always say, you know, if you're asking them, who do you want next? They always say, I'll leave that up to my promoter. But with Pascal, he kind of changed the tone. He said about Adonis Stevenson, who Adonis Stevenson is making a major name for himself in Canada as well, and not just in Canada, but throughout the whole world. But he said he's black and he's Haitian, which really kind of sounded like, I don't want to mix it up with him at all. Do you guys think that was the right thing for him to say, or is it a mind game where he wants to make Adonis seem that he's not going to come through the front door? He's going to try to come through that back door to attack him.
You never know. You never know what someone else is thinking, how they're feeling. My thought is maybe that, you know, John Pascal is trying to make one more run at this thing, and he's looking to do it against the biggest, hardest puncher in that division. And so I think if you look at it from that standpoint, hey, maybe he is trying to play a little game, mind game, and trick him into thinking that, hey, I can take you on, let's do it. And maybe he'll get that guy in there real hot, Adonis Stevenson, getting him to come into the ring all hot and ready for something, and then that'll get him, that'll get John in his rhythm, and we'll see how the fight goes on from there. But I don't know if he can take up Donna Stevens' power, man. That guy can punch.
He's also, like, he's one of those guys a lot like you, where he's awkward, and he knows it, and it works for him, and he knows how to work it. And the thing that I was reading an interview with Donovan George recently, and he said it wasn't so much his speed is functional, you know, it's all right. The power is bone-crunching and ridiculous. But he said the really impressive thing about Adonis Stevenson is his elusiveness. And it's the one thing you don't really count on. But he's kind of off rhythm, and he's kind of funky the way he moves. And he's like, I just couldn't find him. I couldn't get to him. And I think it would make for an interesting fight, but I think the difference, I think Stevenson probably is a little bit better conditioned. He seems like he can go later a little bit better now. Carries his power super late and has more power. just flat out and that awkwardness. So I think it's a fun fight, but I think he comes down the middle, and as opposed to Pascal, who's very wide and just overcommits, doesn't really sit behind a jab, and is not very he based his style on Roy Jones. No jab, no fundamentals, and he's wide open like that. I tell you what, if he looks off to the side and tries to showboat against Adonis Stevenson, he's getting knocked out cold. And I would even pick him a little bit against Kovalev, too. But let me open it up to you guys, since you're the special guest co-host. I know there's probably subjects that you guys want to talk about. So I'm going to leave the floor to you guys to open up a new subject. And what are the things that you are passionate about in the sport?
I'm glad you said passionate. When I was told that I was going to come on and host today, and I was trying to come up with something to talk about, my dad gave me an idea, and I said, you know what, let's run with that one. He said that we should speak about the Olympic program right now, where it's headed, the direction that USA Boxing is going in, and me being out of the Olympic organization for almost 5 years now, it's really, really changed. The guys are taking off headgears, the women are coming into the Olympic Games now. There's just a lot of movement going on right now, and I kind of wanted to hear everyone else's thoughts on what they think the future for USA Boxing is going to be, and also for, let's say, the Olympic Games, as well as amateur boxing having, you know, the open division taking off the headgears now.
I'm going to jump right in with it. Dave and I were two of the first people in the business to get involved in this WSB World Series of Boxing thing, where they started taking off the headgear and calling them, you know, semi-pro. They could keep their amateur status, but they were going to get paid. And initially, I kind of liked the idea of team boxing and kind of, you know, returning back to the old ways of no headgear so we could develop stars. But the more I watched the fights, and then the more I found out that AIBA, they didn't have that deal where these guys would keep their pro records, you know, intact, and they could turn pro 0-0, and they didn't tell the fighters, from what a lot of the fighters told me. And I do have an email that where they laid out a plan to the Association of Boxing Commissions, and they gave this proposal of what they wanted, and they were turned down. And then it turned out they didn't tell the fighters that they were turned down, and they just kind of proceeded. The more I just think that it's wrong. And I was told yesterday that, I don't know if you guys heard this, that the Nationals are not doing well in terms of attendance of fighters. But because of the no headgear, it's dropped as much as, I think, 75%. And, they went from a ton of fighters to, like, not many fighters at all. There was one fighter, Marlon Esparza, that I think they had to push back one of her fights. She's only fighting twice because there wasn't enough people to fight against. So I think that USA Boxing is in a lot of trouble financially and in terms of what AIBA is trying to do internationally.
Well, this is Loquacious again. They've been in trouble. Yeah, I like that. I don't know how to spell it, but they've been in trouble for quite a while. I don't know what the number is now, but when I was involved with the programs at some point in time, there were like, I don't know, there must have been like 9 presidents of USA Boxing in like 7 years, something ridiculous that, you know, there's no foundation, there's no structure there. So that's been they've been in a flux for quite a while. Now, you know, you're reaching, you're trying for something new with taking the headgears off. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to pull more of the fans that like the professional fights in comparison to the amateur fights. You're trying
right.
to pull those guys. And now you're taking it all the way to Spokane, Washington. And you've got X amount of different divisions. I haven't re-registered. I'm level 4 with USA Boxing, so that puts me like at the top. You know, if I wanted to take an international trip or do Olympics, and you know, I'm qualified to do all that type of stuff, but I haven't even re-registered because, you know, I'm wondering if it's even worth my time now. You know, other rule changes, like, you know, our last Olympic gold medalist in the men's division was Andre Ward, and we've had a gold medal since then. It's the young lady from Michigan, Clarissa.
Clarissa, yeah.
Clarissa Shields. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, Clarissa Shields. She is not allowed to box in the top-level division now because of her age. And so here you are again, you know, cutting your nose off to spite your face. She had to box in a younger division because of her age, even though she won an Olympic gold medal. So, you know, so many different things going on with that program. You know, there's no structure, there's no foundation that, you know, the kids can hold on to. And it doesn't appear like it's going to get any better anytime soon. As you said, 75% of the fighters didn't. There's 75% drop off. That's really bad.
I don't understand. Like, what I mean, like you just said right now, there's no structure to this. Is there just too many hands in this cookie jar or something? I mean, because obviously, there's no money in it. They're hurting for money. They're hurting for fans to even be intrigued by it. So how can this structure be so out of whack where somebody can just sit down and go, look, this is what the problem is. This is what we need to fix. And let me ask you this. Have you spoken to any other coaches out there that feel the same way like you guys, saying, you know what, I'm not sure if I want to get involved in it anymore?
No, I haven't spoken to any. I've got some fighters that some young boxers, I won't call them fighters at this point, they're amateurs, that have been calling me saying, Coach, I won, you know, and they're at the U.S. tournament, Coach, I won, and, you know, I'm doing good and that kind of thing. And I said, well, who you got next? Well, I got a bye tomorrow, okay? He gets the bye, and then the next day he calls me, and I'm expecting him to tell me, you know, who he boxed and how'd it go tonight. Well, I didn't box today because there was nobody for me to box. So,
wow.
No, I haven't spoken to any other coaches, but it's very chaotic, and I would take a guess and say that any of them that have put in the time that I put in, they're probably not really wanting to be a part of that anymore. I mean, and that's not that we don't want to be a part of, you know, a program that helps children. Yes, we want to be a part of a program that helps kids, young adults. But to be a part of something that's as chaotic or a part of something that you don't know what you're going to get day to day, what's going to happen, that's just not, you know, it's not good for the kids. It's not good for the coaches. I'm quite sure there's a lot of coaches that are there that are voicing their opinions about that right now.
What do you guys think it puts the state of boxing if it just continues like this? I mean, what do you think happens to the future of boxing?
Well, it's not going to be good. It's not.
Right.
You know what? Just you saying that, because we already know the state of boxing is really bad in itself. You know, we've had a lot of bright spots, especially in 2013. I saw a lot of good things. I'm sure you guys felt good about the year we had. But, you know, this is our feeder program. This is that's supposed to be the foundation.
Right.
That leads to future world champions and future professionals. Like, you know, you look back and you see Andre Ward had a long career, stellar career in the amateur program, capped it off with a gold medal, and he moves on to the professional ranks and continues with that success. A lot of your guys that you see on the high level in the professional ranks did the same thing. This was where they got their foundation. So our young boxers come along now. They need some stability in order to transition from an amateur to a professional boxer.
Wow, that's just, man.
Yeah, I think, too, you know, you look at the criticism that the USA boxing team got this last Olympics for not winning a medal, and I think it's really unfair because, one, I think our guys over here fight in a more pro style. They don't face international competition on a regular basis because they don't have the money to travel over there. They don't have the team support. So when you get them against, and we saw this in the WSB, there was one match in particular. It was the Matadors against Russia. And it was one of the roughest nights of boxing I'd ever seen. And these kids, there was only one kid that did very well in that. And he's now the ranked Jason Quigley. He's now ranked the number one middleweight in the amateurs, and he's turning pro. and that's a world ranking. It's because he had had international experience. He came and joined the team so he could get some of this pro experience before trying to go and get in the Olympics. But you're basically putting these kids, with the exception of Rashid Warren, who's an older amateur or was, against men and guys that are facing other countries all the time, facing
right.
all these different styles. So let me ask you guys this. Do you think it was a knock on USA Boxing's the fighters themselves that they didn't medal, or was that really just like a microcosm of how bad the program has become?
I can give you guys some insight on the mentality of amateur boxers that are going to the Olympic Games and looking to turn pro, because I was one of those guys. I fought in the under-19 World Championships. I was 18. I was in Morocco, in Africa, and then also I fought in 2007 Pan American Games in Brazil. We, with the exception of me, because I really wanted it, it was in my heart to do it, was win a gold medal, an Olympic gold medal. I didn't get there. A lot of fighters here, when they're faced with going to the Olympic Games and they know that they have something after that to look forward to, they're looking forward to that money, that check, that signing bonus, that being on TV, that being in the spotlight, more than they are looking forward to getting a medal. Forget a gold medal, looking forward to getting a medal at all, or even just representing their country in front of millions in other countries, you know, and showing their best. And so from that standpoint, you can't put a knock on the fighters, because a lot of the time, or most of the time, our mentality isn't focused on winning medals or representing our country. Our focus is on money and fame and looking forward to a great professional career and becoming one of the greatest professional fighters of all time. So from that standpoint, yeah, you can knock the fighters. But on the other hand, too, we spoke on USA Boxing earlier, how out of whack it is, how there's no control, how there's no stability. It starts with the training. It starts with the program. That's the foundation. Without that, then you don't produce good fighters that look forward to going to championships and winning medals and representing their country. So it goes hand in hand. At the end of the day, I would first, you know, point to the establishment, USA Boxing, and then I would look at the fighters as well.
I'm wondering, too, I guess, you know, because this show's all, and myself and Dave are really about not just pointing out problems but solutions. What do you guys think is the solution? How do we advertise these? How do we get these guys more money, I guess, is what they're missing? Is you know, I know Bill Pullian, formerly of the Ravens administration, is now on the board of directors for USA Boxing. What do you guys think is a way to kind of resurrect this program? You know, I mean, I'm open to suggestions, you know, a car wash, something, you know.
But you know what?
I'm going to
just really quick to add that, just to add to what he just asked you guys right now, because there's another question, is how much in danger is it not having this program, amateur program, taking this completely out? Is it for American fighters? I mean, it's already tough enough for American fighters to get exposure, to get the backing from other Americans. But what does it do for them? Like, you know, what is the route for them now without having this program to get in the pro rankings and get the exposure?
Wow. Well, let me say this, and I'll give the other view from what Sean was saying when he was trying to make the Olympic team. I'll give the view from the coaching standpoint. You know, the administration, and this is not, I'm not knocking, I'm just kind of pointing out some of the things that I know that I dealt with and we dealt with
right.
during that last Olympic 2012 team. The administration, the things that go on, the changing of the CEOs and the presidents and the vice presidents and the sanctions that are put against the program, and, you know, not having any money and not being able to travel and take these boxes to international events and things like that. You hamstring, you know, us in every way, and the kids suffer the most because of that. As Sean was saying, that, you know, the kids envision money and travel and fame and being on television and things like that. I was part of the 2012 Olympic boxing coaching staff. Not a lot of people know that because probably about three months before the games, they got rid of the head coach. And when the head coach left, then as far as I was concerned, it was time for me to go too. I was the technical coach for the team. It was my job to make sure that everybody was technically sound and also to study the other countries, which I did, logged a lot of film on the other fighters from the other countries. And so we put a lot of time and effort into creating a different mindset with the boxers, from the ESPN to Showtime to HBO mentality to a more patriotic mentality. And one of the things we did was every morning before we began to practice, before we ran, before we did anything, we took them outside at the Olympic Training Center, stood in front of the flag, and we had them pledge allegiance and also sing the national anthem. Every day we did this.
Right.
To change their mindset from that mindset of I want to be on TV to make them see that this you're fighting for this flag. You're fighting for your country. So, you know, Sean told the other side from the boxer, I'm telling you from the coaching standpoint, we really tried to implement this. And we felt that it was working. But just a few months before the games, you know, they decided to you know, make a change, and that really, it hurt the kids. The kids are the ones that suffered. And if you watch the games, you saw coaches that didn't have the experience to be there, and also the guy that they chose to be the head coach wasn't even allowed to work in the corner because he didn't meet the approval of the Olympics, the International AIBA Boxing Association. So, you know, who suffers because of that? That's the kids. Where did that start? That started in the main office. As far as making changes and doing things and what we could do to make things better for those boxers, I'm going to just say off the top of my head, just an idea. You know, your Andre Wards, your Sean Porters, your Bernard Hopkins, your Oscar De La Hoyas, those type of guys, you know, your Floyd Mayweather Juniors, those type of guys, they need to sit down to a table together and say, hey, guys, it's going to take money and it's going to take teamwork. Let's form something. Let's put some money on the table. Let's form an idea. Let's put some thoughts together and do something to help the program and help these kids so that we can get gold medals. And that would be a start, because they look up to these guys. They're coming up in the ranks. They see these guys on television. They want to be like these guys, and that's what they're looking forward to being. But if these guys can actually sit down and get their attention and say, hey, listen, I'll get behind you and support you if you will commit to fighting for this flag. So, you know, that's just a thought.
That's a really good thought.
Yeah, there's a piece I've been working on, and what you said really relates to it in terms of a lot of these kids come from, a lot of them came out of Ohio, and I remember talking to a few people, and I'm writing a piece about basically the U.S. drug war, which is now heading into its 43rd year, and what it's done to the inner cities and what it's done to communities, community centers, and to boxing in particular. Back in the day, we used to have a lot of heavyweight contenders. We had a lot of guys to choose from. And the premise of the piece, and I think it spreads to other divisions, but and the title of the piece is The American Heavyweight Champion of the World is Dead or in Jail. And my thinking is that we've kind of killed off a lot of these guys that could have been great, but also there's an apathy and a sense that and I'm talking in the Mexican-American community, the poorer white community and the African-American community, which, in my opinion, has been targeted almost most of all. I mean, the numbers are staggering. You know, something like 40 million arrests, something like that, over the summer. Not 40 million, I'll have to pull up my stats, but it's a ridiculous amount. We've spent like $42 million, and it's like 5 million arrests, something like that, over the time. And we're not talking about deaths. We're not talking about families that are ripped apart, you know, with those stats. And so I kind of wonder, like, when you're talking about of having to kind of retrain is a bad term, but I mean, it's the only one I got, this mindset that the system is against us and every man for himself, why would I fight for a country that's been doing nothing but destroying my community and putting my family and friends in jail or killing them? And the laws are getting worse and worse and worse. Was that something that you guys were kind of fighting against in that like, look, this is your flag, this is your country, and we're fighting for it? And what you're saying is that when they switched the coach, it basically reinforced the idea that the old system doesn't really give a shit about us. Does any of that make sense?
Yeah, that's true. And trust and believe that if I had wanted to, I could have stayed. But, you know, when you got rid of my captain and I was there for him, it was time for me to go. And the choice at that point was go to Beijing or go with Sean when he was getting ready to fight Afonso Gomez. And if they had fought for the flag, and I'm in the front office, like I was fighting for the flag, like the kids wanted to fight for the flag, and we had some good fighters on there, you know, on that team. If they had fought for us, like we were fighting for them, you know, I probably would have stayed. But, you know, there was no reason to. And in that situation, I'm quite sure a lot of the boxers probably felt like they were let down. They were walking to the ring with trainers and coaches that they didn't know and hadn't spent time with. I mean, we had been in camp with these kids for 3 and 4 months. You know, I've spent 45 days in a row at the Olympic Training Center, go home for 2 weeks and come back and stay another 45 days. Go over to Azerbaijan and stay there for 2 or 3 weeks. I went to Ukraine and I went to Siberia. That was 30 below zero. I was doing everything I could to make sure that these kids were successful. I was there with the Errol Spence. I was there with, you know, with these guys, and I'm quite sure they felt like they were let down, and, you know, when they walked, you know, to that ring, they probably didn't feel that everything was done in their favor for them to be successful.
It's hard to stick around when they're sabotaging everything, too. You know what I mean? I mean, I don't blame you. You know, if somebody's going to sabotage what the foundation you're laying, what's the point now? You know, it's like, okay, well, what next? What else are you going to throw? Another curveball at me? So I'm fighting against it. Now you're losing focus of the purpose of you being there, which is to get these kids prepared and ready to fight for the flag. But how can you do your job if you have to worry about who's coming from behind you? You know, that's really.
That's true, and the add on to the idea that I had. We as the athletes that I mentioned, you know, the Floyd Mayweathers, the Andre Wards, the Sean Porters. Those type of guys, and then mentioning Errol Spence, you know, he was part of that Olympic team, and he's now, you know, 12-0 or 15-0, wherever he is. They need to allow those guys to have a voice in that room for those decisions with these Olympic teams, for the decisions for these international competitions, and preparation for getting prepared for the Olympics. You know, I believe in the year prior to the games, I believe we only had 2 international competitions. We went to the World Championships in Azerbaijan, and then I took a team to Ukraine and Russia. That was it. They had no preparation and fell into preparing to fail. So there was no preparation.
Brutal. Yeah, that's basically it. And you compete or perform how you prepare. And just to get my stats correct here, it's 43 years, $1 trillion, 45 million arrests. Those are the stats of the U.S. drug war. It can't be denied that it was done to this country. And you look at it, here we are discussing a program that
that builds men. You know, Emanuel Steward is a big part of that program when he was still with us. Ann Wolf is another person that really helps amateurs in her part of the country. And both of them would say to me, I don't build fighters, I build adults. You know, I hopefully build these kids into people that would be not just great fighters, but productive members of society. And here we are going, how do we spend money on this so we can help build this program that helps kids that, you know, become this? We're going in the wrong direction. It's a travesty.
Absolutely. But, we're going in the wrong direction because a lot of these corporations are getting involved in government decisions by solving the problem is by building more prisons for these kids rather than try to reform them into being adults and taking away these boxing programs and such things like that. I mean, I grew up 9 years old. I walked in a gym with my grandfather, you know, and he was trying to get me on the right track. I mean, you know, I don't even know what to say about that, you know, and sabotaging our system and having all these guys come in to have, you know, an education that should be easy for them to go, you know what, this is the problem and this is how we need to organize and align things so that we have the proper funding flow coming in to train these kids and keep these programs going and get them off the streets so we can clean our streets. To me, it's almost like a way of these organizations saying, like, we don't want to clean these streets up. What we want to do is just continue to, you know, lace our pockets and forget about the fact that our economy is in a shamble right now.
Yeah, that's one expert on the drug wars calls it a sausage factory, where you just kind of keep moving people through the system and it doesn't really fix itself. You know, it just perpetuates. But let's transition here with our co-host. We got 15 minutes left. We got fights this weekend, and we need your expertise to break them down. I'll just run through the schedule, and you guys, since we got, you know, four of us to discuss and only 14 minutes, I'll just hit the TV schedule. Friday night, Resorts International, Atlantic City, New Jersey, NBC Sports, Curtis Showtime Stevens at a quick turnaround takes on Patrick the Machine Majewski, middleweights, 10 rounds. We won't break down the undercard fight, but what do you guys think about that? What do you guys think about Curtis Stevens, Patrick Majewski?
I don't know much about the Patrick guy. I do know Curtis Stevens, a hard puncher. We'll see what he's got left. I can't really break that fight down at all because I'm not very aware of the Patrick guy at all.
I've actually covered him a little bit, and he's serviceable. He's had a couple losses. He's been stopped before. He's older. He's 34, but he actually came to the sport late. And I think he actually had a martial arts background, if I recall correctly, and now he's a boxer. I would think that the Main Event is trying to keep Curtis a viable franchise, you know, a viable product on TV. I'm just impressed that the guy, you know, takes what he took from Triple G and is like, get me a fight back in January and let's get going.
I think that's
I'm
the right way to. Yeah, but I also think it's the right way to build back Curtis's, his self-esteem. You know, he gets dropped, he gets beaten by Triple G. Why throw him back to the wolves? You know, let him rebuild himself back up. You know, his last real major loss was the contender guy. I can't remember his name for life of me right now. But they didn't throw him back to the wolves. They allowed him to rebuild himself back up. I think this is the right way the Main Event should do things. And I think it's a good fight for him to get himself back out there. And just to remind people that he's a big power puncher. He's an exciting guy. And that's why everybody did tune in to watch him fight Triple G. They thought that he was going to be able to pull something off, you know, with his power. So it's a good matchup, in my opinion.
Jesse Brink.
Well,
go ahead, Ken.
Well, let me say this. I'm a lot like Sean in that respect of not knowing much about Patrick Majewski, but I know a lot about Curtis Stevens. I've been watching him as I've seen his amateur career through on into his professional career. And actually, before Sean was a pro and Curtis was a pro and Sean was still an amateur, I took Sean to New York, and he actually sparred with Curtis. So I know Curtis firsthand. What he's can do and what he's capable of. I think that, you know, them putting this guy in front of him doesn't have a long history of amateur background and was in other fighting. Did you say martial arts? He was involved with other sports. This is the right type of fight to get Curtis back there, and you know they're bringing him back pretty quick, which is good as well. Don't let him sit and mope about it, you know. So I think that's a good one for him. You know, obviously, you know he stepped up against Triple G, and he, you know, like a lot of other guys, was not successful. But you know, to give him an opportunity against somebody else, is especially a short, in a small period of time since the fight, that's big, that's huge, because this is going to, you know, get him right back in there, get him going, and hopefully he stays focused and he'll get another shot, maybe not Golovkin, but someone else.
That's heart, though, too, man. I got to applaud him, too, just to get back in there after that loss. I mean,
absolutely.
It just showed,
absolutely,
showed a lot. Yeah, it just showed a lot what kind of a fighter he is, you know. So I applaud him for that, and I hope everything goes well for him.
Moving down to same night, Friday night, Fantasy Springs, Fox Sports 1 in Indio, California, Cornelius Bundridge, Joey Hernandez, and Antonio Orozco versus Miguel Ureta. I tend to think these are kind of more showcase kind of fights. I got K9 Bundridge. I got Orozco, who's always all action. What do you guys think?
Yeah, same as you. I'm going with Bundridge. I like what he's done. He's on the tail end of his career, but he's still exciting. He's still likable. He's still still someone everyone likes to watch.
I got the same pick too. I think though, you know, I think with Cornelius Bundridge is in my, you know, with me now is he's got more of a fight outside the ring than he does inside the ring. You know, we had a report about his finance and his deals. I mean, he's even calling back Don King to kind of step in and try to get him back to that title fight. So he's got a long way, you know. I wouldn't say I'm a guy that's going to run to see him fight all the time, but if the fight's interesting, I'm going to watch it. And this one is just a match that Golden Boy just kind of threw up in the air and nobody wanted to buy it, and Bungridge was stuck with it. So I got the same picks you got there, Gabriel.
Let's get down to there's another fight on ESPN, Rico Ramos, Jonathan Arellano. That's a fun fight because Ramos is always
that's
vulnerable.
A good fight. Yeah.
Arellano is always all action. I tend to go with the faster guy in Ramos because Arellano is starting to get caught, stopped, or get hurt. But I think it's a fight where anything can happen.
I like Arellano, man. I think that Arellano is a volume puncher. He's not a power puncher, but he's a guy that's going to be right there in your chest. And with Rico Ramos, I still think he's a little shell shock. I still think that, you know, Styles made fights. Rigondeaux power is what destroyed him, but I think it took a little bit away from the confidence. And I think that Arellano just needs to step in there and be himself. He's going to get caught coming in, but, you know, that's boxing. You're going to get hit in order to get your punches in. So I think he can overwhelm Rico Ramos. You know what I mean?
No, correct. That he's starting to get dropped. He hasn't been stopped. And so I'm just kind of wondering if that's where it's leading. So
right.
What do you guys think?
Well, you know, I know Rico personally. I know that he loves boxing. He loves to make money. He loves to fight. He's a competitor. So I'm going to take him with that one. I like his speed. I like his quickness in this fight.
Yeah, I kind of tend to lean that way. Okay, these are the big ones. 7 minutes to go. Saturday night at the Garden, at the theater at the Garden, Mikey Garcia on HBO versus Juan Carlos Burgos, super featherweights for the WBO title, and then Bryant Jennings versus Arthur Spilka. I just like when he fights because I like saying Spilka. I like Mikey Garcia in this. I think he's facing a guy that doesn't have a lot of power, that does seem to be struggling with the weight a little bit because he's really tall for the weight. I just think it's a nice, you know, Bruce Trampler top rank special. And they're trying to build Mikey Garcia towards Pacquiao because they don't have any more opponents for Pacquiao because of the Cold War between Top Rank and Golden Boy. And so they're not going to take any chances. I got Mikey Garcia in 9 rounds.
I got Mikey with me too as well. Yeah.
Yeah, me as well. He's a big guy. He's a big for his weight. And he's got a lot of experience. He's got just, you know, great boxing skills, and I think he'll take care of this guy too.
I think so too. You know, I mean, I'm not completely sold on Mikey yet. I'm not one of those that are going to be jumping up and down thinking that Mikey's going to be ready after Barrios and maybe taking another fight, moving up in weight. He's going to be ready for Manny Pacquiao. I think if you look at the oppositions that he's been put up against, it's there. It was there for him to look good. It was there for him to capitalize on what his abilities are. Did he get dropped in his last fight? Yeah, but you know what? A lot of great champions have been dropped and got back up and do their thing. I'm not just sure yet, though, if I can call Mikey Garcia a great fighter. I think there's still more left in him to find out where he's at. If this year he gets to Manny Pacquiao, hey, kudos to him. The money's there. But in my opinion, sometimes a fighter can be a bit rushed to get to that money flow, man. You know, why get one check? I like to see guys get several big checks because they're there with a purpose, and they're there to prove that they have greatness in them.
Hey, let me ask a quick question.
Go ahead.
Are they forcing Mikey Garcia down our throats? Are we being forced to this kid or what?
It feels like it.
Yeah, and I mean, it sounds like absolutely, no doubt, it's the top-ranked machine working here because what weight class is this kid in?
130. He's a super
he's 130. Coming from
and
one,
he's gonna
yeah.
Jump, and he's going to jump all the way up to welterweight.
Yes.
Well, he just had Alex Caruso with him, so, you know, he did that with Pacquiao in like a year.
Well, that'll help.
That'll
help you get to the weight class, that's for sure. But, I mean, the question I'm asking is, you know, instead of allowing a guy to fight and allowing us as fans to choose to get behind him, they're forcing
right.
it. And I'm not comfortable with that. You know, I'm not comfortable with that in a lot of different ways. You know, if I'm the guy that's buying the ticket, I don't like that. I want to root for who I want to root for. I want to go and pay my money to see the guy I want to see. And, you know, they're forcing it. You know, I'm not comfortable with that.
You know what I'm not comfortable with either is the analogy of, well, you know, we did it with Manny Pacquiao, put him in with De La Hoya, and so it should work for, there's a strong possibility possibility it's going to work for Mikey Garcia. Come on, man. Really? I mean, you know, Oscar was already really out on the tail end of his career. Manny, to me, doesn't really look like he's there, you know? And, I just hate seeing promoters trying to make a star out of somebody right away. What is the rush? What is the big rush? There's a lot of fights for this kid to get in there and build himself. Okay, he doesn't get a Manny Pacquiao maybe 3 or 4 years ago, but boxing has proven that we are able to dig up another star. I mean, hey, 2-3 years from now, if Sean is still, you know, welterweight champion, hasn't moved up, there's a great potential fight there. You know, there's things in boxing that we need to tag on to. We've become more of a social media society, you know, where we want everything right there and then, you know, I think it's ridiculous too. I agree with you big time.
Moving to the Bryant Jennings Silva, I think it's going to be a fun fight. It's a war. I don't think whoever emerges is going to be the next heavyweight champion, but it's going to be a fun heavyweight fight. But we got 2 minutes. This is a fight I really want everybody to weigh in on. Over on Showtime at the D.C. Armory in Washington, D.C., Lamont Peterson versus Thierry Jean for Peterson's IBF title, and Jermair Charlo versus Gabriel Rosado. It's a tough fight. I think it's a real fight. I think Jean is a live dog in this fight. I haven't really quite made a pick yet, but I'm kind of leaning toward Thierry Jean.
Well, I'm gonna
really?
Tell you what, he is a live dog. He is a live dog in this fight, and considering some of the, recent fight that Lamont had against Matisse, I believe there's some doubts going into a fight of him being able to perform at his previous level. But I know the kid. I know the kid personally, and I don't doubt him. But, you know, I know the other guys is a live dog in the fight. It's 50-50 for me right now. This is a 50-50 fight.
I agree.
You know, I mean, I agree with you about the mentality that Lamont might come in. But Derry, he tries to mimic that Floyd Mayweather style. I think that Lamont could take advantage of that, you know, because, you know, Derry has to be he basically has to set his own rhythm, you know. I haven't seen him kind of adjust. He's got a nice straight right. But if he sits and waits and thinks that Lamont's going to try to be the boxer that he used to be, I think he's in for a rude awakening. I think Lamont will jump all over him if the mentality's there. And he wants to make a statement saying the Matisse thing, hey, it just happened. It happens in boxing. Or it takes over his mentality and he's gun shy. But you know what? I'm going with Lamont Peterson. I think that he's gonna do his thing, man. I think he's gonna prove that, you know what, we get knocked out when we stick our neck out, right?
Yeah, I agree. And I'm gonna go upset special. I mean, some people say he's too young. I'm going to go with Charlo in this. I know Gabe Rosado is a more experienced kid, but Ronnie Shields is a good trainer I really respect. He wouldn't make a fight that he didn't think his guy could win. I think Charlo pulls this one out, but it's going to be a fun fight.
Yeah, I like Rosado.
I go with Charlo. That's a big fight. Rosado's got the experience. We know that. He takes a lot of punishment in his fights, and it looks like he doesn't mind to do that. I think that Charlo is the smarter, stronger, younger fighter in this fight, and I think he wins.
I like Rosado. I mean, I know he takes a lot of punishment, but he's kind of shown me some glimpse of boxing. You know, he does have an IQ there. You know, he's not a complete punching bag for somebody. I think for Charlo, it's a big step up for him. But we're going to find out, man. I mean, we're going to find out if this was the right choice for you know, the Charlo team, or if this is just, you know, Rosado is as good as he is in taking a punch. Is he good enough to beat a guy that is younger and has, I think, a better boxing skill level? So, but I'll go with Rosado.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, I had both Charlo brothers, North Michigan, when they were 14, and both of those guys, very good fighters. I'm going to go with Charlo on that one, and whoever the other Charlo brothers got coming up, I'm going to go with him on that one as well.
Well, there it is. I know there's a Marco Hook rematch, but we're already kind of over time. So, Dave, I'll just turn it over to you for the wrap. And Ken and Sean, really fantastic job. And I really appreciate the hour that you gave us, and it's really just fun stuff. Dave?
We got to do this again. Honestly, man, I mean, even about the Olympics, I'm really glad you guys brought that up, and it was a great topic. And I know a lot of listeners are going to be like, hey, man, get them back on. Let's talk a little bit more about this Olympic thing here, because that is a major problem. And it's going to be the death of American boxing, in my opinion, if we allow this and not continue to talk about this. Guys, thank you again for taking the time. It was awesome. I enjoyed it.
Thanks a lot for having us on. And before we completely wrap it up, I just need a city. You don't have to tell me why, but Seattle or Denver?
Denver. Denver.
I'm going to go with Denver. Yeah, Denver.
You both going with Denver? All right, I'll put 25 clock push-ups on Seattle.
There you go. All right, no problem.
I'll take that challenge. I'll take that challenge.
Very good.
I can do this.
You guys have a great day, all right?
You too, right, man. Thank you again.
You too.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you, Sean. Oh, I'm sorry, Loquacious and Sean.
Loquacious.
Thank you so much. I'll see you guys soon.
Well, there you go. The end of the show of Leaving the Ring Radio. Hey, I hope you guys all enjoyed the special guest that we have with us here on Leaving the Ring. Anyways, Fight fans, again, enjoy your weekend. Don't drink and drive, because you will spill your beer. Mr. Gable.
Dave, as always, fun show. What kind of push-ups did I just agree to do? I'll catch you after the fights, and to everybody, enjoy the fights and peace.